Just a couple of hours ago, President Trump convened another cabinet meeting, in which case he was asked, as he always is, about what's going on with the Iran war. Are we close to a negotiated settlement? Has anything been agreed to by the Iranian side? Are we looking to go back to war, et cetera? All these questions were normally peppered. But underneath all of these is the central issue upon which the entire American economy runs, and that is on cheap and significant amounts of energy. And everything is being curtailed by what's going on in the Persian Gulf right now through this Gulf of Hormuz, the Strait of Hormuz, as a result of this war here. Now, the market has been acting in very peculiar ways, in ways that it hasn't before, especially not reflecting the fundamentals that are at play and the significant percentage of global oil and gas and other derivatives that have been blocked from getting out through the Gulf. But they haven't seemed to been having the effect on the markets or even in our life in America, as one might expect. The problem is that is not a condition that is going to be extended much longer, and we're trying to get cut through the BS and the claims that are made by many of the administration, its supporters, and what is really going on the ground, and most importantly, what we can expect come and do. And we have nobody better today to talk to that the first time on our show. An old friend of mine, somebody I've known for many years, Art Berman, who is a geologist and energy consultant, and is very prolific and active on X. And a lot of people pay a lot of attention to his analysis, not the least of which Commodore Steve Jeremy, who's on our show a lot. He holds you in very high regard. So first of all, Art, welcome to the show. Delighted to have you here.
Well, thanks so much for having me. And Steve is a mutual friend, and I think someone we both respect a lot for many reasons.
We do, for many reasons indeed. Listen, one of the other reasons why I'm really glad to have you here is because your whole career you have made of kind of the symbolism that we have it here at the show of being unintimidated and uncompromised to tell the truth no matter what people think. And man, do we need a lot of that today. Let's start off by showing what President Trump said regarding oil just a few minutes ago from the Oval, or from his cabinet meeting.
Captain said the United States has so much oil that we are an export of oil. So we have plenty of oil. We're very lucky. We're blessed with the greatest piece of land in the world from that standpoint. And we have more than anybody else. And now when you add Venezuela to it, we have, I think, 64% of the world's oil. And we're getting along very well with Venezuela, by the way. It's being run really beautifully. The big companies are moving in. It's going to be amazing because it's also, like us, they're very blessed in that sense. But we have natural energy that no other country has. We have more than anybody else. So it's really a world problem because most of the world doesn't have that, and we're making it available.
So let's take a look at that first of all, because he's like saying, hey, you know what? We're energy independent. He said that a lot. We got plenty of oil. He just said there it is. So we don't even have to worry about it. I'm going to talk about the Venezuela stuff separately. But what do you say when he says, yeah, we've got plenty of oil, so I don't really care what happens in the Gulf?
Wow. It's hard for me to even know where to start. First of all, we've got more oil than anybody else. Patently untrue. The U.S. plus Venezuela have 64% of the oil in the world. Preposterously untrue. Everything that comes out of this administration when it comes to oil and energy, which is maybe not the only thing I know, but the thing that I know the best, is just, well, I want to step back a little. I don't want to call it a lie, but it's so damn close that it's just false. It's completely, utterly, unsupportably false. End of discussion. Okay, so, but to your question, does whatever amount of energy, let me say, look, he is right in one way. I mean, the United States is blessed, if you want to put it that way. I mean, we have a lot of natural resources. That's one of the reasons that the United States is a great power in the world today. You know, not just oil and natural gas, but water resources. I mean, we could go into a whole discussion of all the strategic reasons that the United States is what it is. So, I don't want to take issue with him because I kind of agree with him, in an overall way. Having said that, however, first of all, in a globalized economy, nobody is immune from anything. Okay. I mean, that's just ridiculous. I mean, if the United States were an island, an economic and cultural island, which was completely self-sufficient unto itself, didn't trade with anybody else, didn't participate in global politics, then, you know, then we could start to, you know, focus in on what parts of his argument still don't work, and there are plenty. But since that's not the case, it's ridiculous to even have this conversation. I mean, so, for instance, if the United States is dependent upon the prosperity of other countries for trade, then if other countries are in desperate conditions because of the scarcity of oil, then that clearly affects the United States. I mean, it's just, you know, it's yeah. You don't have to have a degree in economics to understand that. And so, you know, the kinds of ridiculous statements that he makes give the impression that that's not true. Now, is it true that the United States will be somewhat less affected by what goes on in the Persian Gulf, say, than other countries? And the answer to that is somewhat, yes. I mean, we get, you know, something like 10% of our, I'm rounding here, but something like 10% of our oil comes out of the Persian Gulf. Okay, so that's a whole lot better than a lot of other countries, but 10% is a fair chunk. Okay, so
you know, and I wonder if you can, that's going to surprise a lot of people, and I wonder if you can answer, because there is this mantra that Congress has been saying for a long time that America is energy independent. We don't need anything from anybody else. But that's, if 10% of our oil comes from the Persian Gulf, then that doesn't sound like independent for me. Can you explain to us what we actually do have and what we don't have?
Well, let me just make it real simple for you, Danny. The United States imports 6.5 million barrels of oil per day from somewhere. Now, why in the world would an energy independent nation import more oil per day than all of Europe uses in a day? Okay, we could stop the discussion right there. It's absurd. Okay, so, but what they're talking about, if they're talking about net energy. What does that mean? That means if you take all the oil, natural gas, refined products, coal, electricity, and whatever else you want to lump in there, and you say, all right, let's just add up all of the exports and all of the imports of all those things, convert each one of those into some common unit, you know, whether it's barrels equivalent or joules or British thermal units or whatever, and you add and you do an accounting ledger of that, then you will come up with the answer that we are very slightly a net energy exporter of all of those things. But if you talk about oil, we are absolutely not an exporter. We export about 4 million barrels a day. We import 6.5 million barrels a day. So in the simplest analysis, we are a net importer of about 2.5 million barrels of crude oil and condensate per day. So I mean,
what about President Trump's? Sorry, what about President Trump's claim a week or two ago that he was boasting that all of these empty VLCCs and other tankers that were going to the Persian Gulf are now streaming into all these American ports, and they're just filling up and making us just, you know, hand over fist with a lot of money. How is that working?
Well, it's not working too great, but what business is it that tankers are in? They're in the business of moving oil around. All right. And so if most of the oil in the world is unavailable in the Persian Gulf, then whatever empty tankers there are in the world, and there are plenty of them right now, they got to find a cargo someplace, or else they just lose money hand over fist. So they're going to go to wherever somebody will sell them a barrel of oil. Now, that doesn't mean that they can turn around and sell that barrel somewhere else, but at least they've got a cargo that presumably, well, it's better than having no cargo. Okay, so that's issue number one. But the most important thing that people should ask themselves is, why exactly is it that we export 4 million barrels of oil a day and import 6.5 million barrels a day? Why don't we just keep everything that we have, export none, and be close to energy independent, as some people seem to think we are? And the answer is because the kind of oil the U.S. produces is the wrong kind of oil. Not all oil is the same. What a shock. It's not all the same. So, I mean, for instance,
if, and actually you say that's a shock. That is a shock to most people.
To drink alcohol.
A lot of people think that all oil is oil. So
I'm not hearing
what
you,
is
Danny.
It not?
I'm not hearing you.
Gary, do you have any idea? Can you hear me, Gary?
Still not. I'm sure we can edit this out, right?
This is actually live. Gary, can you hear me?
Yeah. No, you're fine. You haven't changed, Dan.
Okay.
I couldn't hear him.
Can you hear Gary?
I still can't hear him.
Yeah, how about the, can you hear me, Art, by the chunk?
No. I hear you fine, yeah.
Okay.
That's very strange. I don't even know how that's possible. I don't even know what to do with that, Gary.
Art, you can try going out, leave the studio, and come back in.
Okay, I can tell you. In the meantime, if you would ask him about the last question that I just did, that would be great. What does it mean that all oil is not the same?
Art, what Danny's asking is what does it mean that all oil is not the same? Can you just simply just tell us the differences?
Well, yeah, but I think we need to get this technical problem fixed because
Danny's going out and coming back in, so hopefully that'll resolve it on his end. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, let's just say that that you want to drink some alcohol, and I say, what kind you want to drink? I got beer, I got wine, I got whiskey. I got tequila. I got all kinds of different things. Well, I just want to get drunk. Oh, okay. So in other words, you don't want beer and you don't want wine. You know, you want 100 proof Jack Daniels, right? Yeah, that's what you want. Okay. Well, what the United States has is 3-2 beer. So you don't want it. You want the 100 proof Jack Daniels, which you can get from the Persian Gulf and certain versions of Russian crude, but that's not what the United States produces. Now that's that's kind of a crude example, not to make a pun, but it makes the point. Okay, so the kind of oil that we produce here in the United States is what we call light oil. It's sort of like light beer. Okay, so oil, it cooks in the earth. And the more deeply it's buried, the higher the pressure, the higher the temperature, the more the heavier portions of that oil effectively get distilled off. Okay, and so what's left is a very light crude oil, which is wonderful for making things like gasoline and petrochemical feedstocks and plastics. But it's no good at all for making things like diesel, jet fuel, and kerosene. Okay, so what happens is, and it's not just shale. This is pretty much all U.S. oil. It's a geochemical situation. It's got to do with just the stage of cooking that the oil in the United States has undergone. It's not because it's from shale or because it's from something else. Now, it's not 100% true, but it's, it's 90% true. And so basically what happens is that we produce more of the light oil than we can use because we need to make other things than gasoline and petrochemical feedstocks. And so we sell that to somebody else. We export it. And to make up for the heavier oil that we don't have, we buy it from someone else. Now, all of our refineries are designed that way. Okay, this is not something that we can just flip a switch and say, well, we don't want to do that anymore. That was intentional. That was the way things were done and changed to 50 years ago. when diesel became the most important refined product in the world. And by the way, the world runs on diesel. Okay. Now that's an oversimplified statement, but you know, we're trying to make some very important points here. I mean, diesel.
By the way, can you hear me now?
I hear you fine, Danny.
Okay. Very good. Glad to hear that.
So all of the transport in the world, the shipping, the trains, the trucks, they all run on diesel. All of the mining, the extraction runs on diesel. All the oil drilling runs on diesel. Diesel is the hemoglobin of the global economy. And what I just got done telling you is that U.S. oil isn't very good for making diesel. So now if you want to make an argument and say the U.S. is energy independent, but it can't make diesel, which is the hemoglobin of the global economy, then we can have a very interesting conversation, because that ain't going to work. It's just not going to work.
And what percentage of do we get the feedstock for diesel? At what percentage of that comes from the Persian Gulf? And my understanding is a lot of that is also what comes out of Venezuela. Is that correct?
Okay. So I don't want to make this too complicated. 3/4 of the oil the United States imports is from Canada.
Okay.
And the oil from Canada is sort of the inverse of the oil from the United States. It is super heavy. All right. So Canada, most of its oil has been, all the light stuff has been chewed up by bacteria and microbes, because most of it's sitting at the surface. This is what they call the oil sands. These were ancient oil fields that essentially leaked up to the surface and congealed. They kind of froze, and the bacteria have worked on them for, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of years. So all the light stuff has been eaten by the bacteria, and all that's left is tar. They're also called the tar sands. Okay, Venezuela is exactly the same. So in a weird way, so Canadian oil, Venezuelan oil on its own isn't very good for anything. U.S. oil, being the inverse, very light, is good for some things, but not everything. And so you'd like to say that together, you know, we've got a match made in heaven. And so if we combine the heavy stuff from Canada mostly and a little bit from Venezuela, and we combine that with the light from the United States and put all that into a refinery, now we're putting out a product that is needed and useful. Now, it's not quite that simple. You know, you don't just, you know, pour them into a blender and, you know, shake it up and say, okay, you know, here's your martini. You want it stirred or shaken? No, it's not that simple at all. In fact, the heavy oil from Canada and Venezuela has to go into a completely different part of the refinery. And it has to go through completely different processes that are complicated. There has to go through catalytic converters and hydrocrackers and all kinds of stuff, because basically you got to take the tar and you have to add hydrogen to it to, quote, upgrade it to, so you got to add the hydrogen to the carbon to enrich it to the point that it can actually make the diesel and the jet fuel and the kerosene. Because by, you know, in its native state, it isn't any good for anything except, you know, to tar a road with. Okay? I'm serious.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't want to overwhelm you or our, you know, or your viewers with complexity, but to make a point, the name of the refineries that the world uses, including the United, they are called complex refineries for this very reason.
All right. Now that makes it, that's very important to understand. And I appreciate you pointing that out, especially comparing it to the Jack Daniels and stuff. That makes it a lot easier to understand. Let's take a look at something else here. So now I guess here a month or so ago, 3 or 4 weeks ago, when it looked like that things were not going well with the Iran war, oil peaked up to, I think, $119 or so. And then many things happened and it kind of stabilized for a pretty good amount of time at around 100. But now then that it looks like, at least it's being claimed, that we're getting close to a negotiated settlement, which was scuttled again today. We have Mr. Kevin Hassett here, for the White House NEC director here, claims that pretty soon, actually within a month, less than a month, it's going to fall below 85 barrels a day. And then he had this to say on Fox News, I think it was.
As soon as the straits are open, then energy prices are going to plummet like nothing you've ever seen before. There's so much oil sitting in the Gulf. There's so much excess capacity in Saudi Arabia and UAE that prices should drop very, very quickly. And since core inflation has just barely budged because of this temporary circumstance, then I expect that the big positive supply shock is going to overpower oil.
Positive supply shock is coming. Wow, well, that's interesting. A lot of experts we've talked to said this could be Chris Martinson being one, said that this would take like 6 to 8 months in a best case scenario to unwind before anything close to being back to normal once it actually does open up. But here he's saying, next month we're going to be in good shape. Is he right?
It's a bald-faced lie. There's nothing that Kevin Hassett just said there that's true. At least there's no energy credentialed expert that I know, and I know a lot of them, who would agree with anything he just said. So forget about what Art Berman thinks. Forget about what Chris Martinson thinks. You know, go on X and find yourself a half dozen or a dozen credible energy experts, including from central banks who tend to be a little behind the curve. And every single one of them will say, no, everything he just said is wrong. Not true. Absolutely untrue. So, I mean, you know, this guy, I mean, they wheel him out whenever they need, you know, I guess they can't get Mark Zuckerberg to, you know, to be their synthetic life form because he doesn't work for them. And so they, you know, they wheel Kevin Hassett out and they program him to say something that, you know, gets a rise from somebody. And everybody says, oh, great. You know, we got nothing to worry. That's complete nonsense. Absolute, complete nonsense. Untrue. Nothing he said is true.
So let's,
going to quickly go to $80. Oil is never going to go to $80 again. Okay, how about that for a categorical statement? It may go to $80 for a day or a week or something like that, but I would be shocked if the monthly average price of oil ever gets to $70 or $80 again, no matter what happens with the Strait of Hormuz.
Wow. So what makes you say that? Because that is a pretty bold statement.
Because, first of all, we're never getting Hormuz open again. End of discussion. That's just not happening. Okay. I mean, and you have to think about it. I mean, you know, you've got a military background. I mean, if you win the hill that controls everything around you, would you ever give it up? I wouldn't.
I would not either.
I would certainly not without, you know, extracting more than a pound of flesh from my adversary. I'd want, you know, like a ton of flesh. So, I mean, there are entire civilizations in places like Mesoamerica that flourished because they controlled a meander in a river and they charged everybody that went up and down the river a toll to get past that meander loop. And if they didn't pay them, you know, they brought out their, you know, their bows and arrows and their swords or whatever, and they chased them off. Okay, so that's what this great war has done for the United States and the Western world. We have lost the most important energy choke point in the world. Iran has it, and we can talk about the details of what it means that they have it. It's not quite like, you know, it's not like a toll booth on the freeway, but they have something that they never dreamed in a million years they would get. And now they do. So if there's nothing else to talk about militarily, then the U.S. and the West have suffered a gigantic defeat because Iran is now effectively the most powerful country in the world, which it wasn't before the war. And there are a lot of people who say, oh, well, yeah, we've destroyed so much of their blah, 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 you know, their Navy, their Air Force, their infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm sure that some of that is true. I mean, Iran never had an Air Force to speak of, and they never had a Navy to speak of. So when Trump gets up and says, we've destroyed their entire Navy and their entire Air Force, well, if they never really had one to begin with, then we're not really talking about very much there. But again, from a military standpoint, if they are capable of launching drones and anti-ship ballistic missiles and long-range ballistic missiles at will, then who cares if they have an Air Force or a Navy? I mean, you know, the category that we call something doesn't matter. If they are capable of neutralizing our best efforts against them, then I don't, you know, then it doesn't matter what you call it. They are an effective opposing force, and that is what they are.
So let me ask you this. I'm going to show you one other soundbite from President Trump's press conference this afternoon at the in the cabinet meeting. And he's talking about the Strait of Hormuz here. Gary's the one that says Trump Oman. In this comment here, let me ask you, how is this going to be received by those who know the oil industry and know what is real, all the things you just said, and what this is going to mean? Because here's how he's claiming it to the American public.
Would you accept a short-term deal that allows Iran and Oman to control the strait? And would they have to open it immediately, or would you be open to that happening over a period of time?
No, the strait's going to be open to everybody. It's
And who would control
it? It's international waters. Nobody's going to control it. We're going to watch over it. We'll watch over it, but nobody's going to control it. That's part of the negotiation that we have. They would like to control it. Nobody's going to control it. It's international waters, and Oman will behave just like everybody else, and we'll have to blow them up. They understand that. They'll be fine.
So you just laid out in very articulate way that, no, they own the hill in your vernacular there. The Iranians do, and they're not going to give that up. So President Trump can say what he wants. If we could do that, we would have done it in the first 40 days. We can't. So, but when he says that with such confidence, what is the oil industry thinking when they hear that?
The most generous interpretation that I can provide here is, and I alluded to this earlier, they don't own the Strait of Hormuz. It's not like a toll booth for Iran. What they have created is enough risk and disruption that nobody will push a ship through there. No insurance company will insure a tanker to go through there. Nobody will accept the risk. So they effectively control the Strait of Hormuz by disruption. So the president can say that it's an international waterway, and he is correct in saying that. But if nobody will move a tanker through it, then again, you know, what does it matter? It doesn't matter what you call it. If you can't get oil through it, then it's closed. And that's just, that is simply the case. So let's just back up. Let's take the most optimistic scenario, I mean the most wildly optimistic scenario, which says that by some means we, the United States and our allies, Israel and whoever else, you know, is on board today, we offer Iran something that causes them to say, okay, we're done. Everything's going back to the way it was in mid-February. You know, we're moving all of our fast boats and all of our drones and all of our missiles. We're moving them out of, you know, we're leaving the Strait of Hormuz. Okay, that's not going to happen, but let's just say it did. Let's say that the negotiations are successful, and as of June 1st, that is the decision, and everybody agrees on it. Okay, so the first thing that has to happen is that all of the owners of those tankers have to give permission to the captains of those tankers to go through the Strait of Hormuz. Okay, so what are they looking at? They're looking at liability and they're looking at safety. So liability. None of those tankers have insurance right now. Okay, so now you can go out and drive your car without car insurance, and you might get away with it as long as you don't get stopped by the police or have an accident, but you don't really want to do that. Some people might, but you know, a responsible person isn't going to do that. So none of those boats have insurance. All right, so what's it going to take before insurance companies say, okay, we're going to reinstate insurance? Well, they're going to have to believe that the risk is down to some level that it makes sense for them to issue insurance. So right now we know there are mines, okay, that we just attacked some Iranian vessels over the weekend because they were laying mines. We don't know how many mines. Doesn't matter if there's one mine or 1,000 mines, there are mines. Okay, so Iran says, all right, we're out of here. All right, how long does it take before there's enough minesweepers that move through there that they can now say, okay, we're 100% guaranteed that all the mines are gone? I don't know. How long? Is that a month? Is that 2 months? Is that 2 weeks? I don't know. But it isn't overnight. Okay, it's some period of time. All right, so once that happens, then the insurance companies will, they'll get their gears going, and maybe in a month after that, or 6 weeks, or 2 months, you know, their underwriters are going to come back, and they're going to write letters to the ship owners and say, okay, this is what you used to pay for insurance to go through the strait. Now it's 5 times as much, but, you know, take it or leave it. That's what we're offering. All right, so they're going to go back to their owners and their boards, and they're going to talk about that. So we're going to go around in circles for, let's just say, 2 months, or let's be generous and say 4 to 6 weeks before anybody feels like, all right, now, you know, we can start to move. All right, so how many tankers are inside the Persian Gulf? I don't know exactly. A couple of hundred, you know, pushing 1,000 perhaps. All right, so if everybody's in a movie theater and suddenly, okay, well, the movie's over, you know, everybody, you know, leave the movie theater. Well, you know, it's not like everybody just runs out the door. You know, everybody's got to wait for the person next to them to get up and, you know, get their purse or, you know, put down their popcorn, or there's somebody with a walker or a wheelchair or something. And it's going to take, you know, by the time everybody queues up to orderly get out of the movie theater, you know, it's going to take 15, 20 minutes. Well, it's going to take all these tankers something like 3-4 weeks to reposition themselves so that they're actually in a queue to get out of the Persian Gulf. All right, so let's just say a month to get the insurance, let's say another 2-3 weeks to start moving out of the Persian Gulf. Okay, now how long does it take for those tankers to get to where they're going? Well, you know, it depends on where they're going, obviously. But on average, it's going to take, you know, 4 to 6 to 8 to 12 weeks to get where they're going. And all this time, all these places that they're going haven't had any oil. All right, so now let's just say on average, it'll be 2 months before that oil arrives. So now we're 4 months from an optimistic decision. So now we're June, July, August, September. June, July, August. So we're at the end of September before any oil arrives anywhere. Okay, now we've talked about the flows. What about the production? 12 million barrels per day of oil is shut in the Persian Gulf, in Saudi Arabia, Iraq, United Arab Emirates, Qatar, etc. All right, now a lot of that production or the loading facilities are damaged by missiles. So all that has to be repaired. Now, when you turn on an oil well after it's been turned off, I mean, you know, there may be a switch that you can flip, okay? But it doesn't come on just all of a sudden, oh, good, you know, the power's back, we're good. So the analogy I like to use is when you have a plumber come to your house and he turns off the water. You know, he does whatever he does, he leaves, and of course you don't remember, you know, this was going to happen, but the first time you turn on the sink or the shower, what happens? You know, or it makes a lot of noise and it spits, and it, you know, the pipes make a lot of noise because the pressure was interrupted. Well, you know, that's your house with, you know, a very clean piece of plumbing that goes, you know, maybe 40 feet from your house to the water main. We're talking about oil wells that go miles underground into not a water main, but a rock, you know? And so when you turn that well on, it's going to do exactly what your water pipes do, except it's going to do it for weeks, maybe months. We don't know, until things stabilize because of the complexity of the system. Now, a report that I just read yesterday by Rabobank says that 700,000 barrels a day of Persian Gulf production is lost forever, that those reservoirs are damaged and it's never coming back. Now, I know the guys at Rabobank, and I'm sure they'll tell you that's not a hard number, but that's probably a middle-of-the-road number. So, you know, that's a big number.
That's a big
number. That's just never coming back. Reservoirs damaged, pipes are broken, and it's not worth fixing them, okay? So, for the rest of it, how long does it take before all the plumbing, you know, works again? And everything is flowing. I don't know, months. All right, what about the damage? How long does that take? Well, who's going to pay for it? Somebody's going to have to put up the money for it. All right, now the big liquefied natural gas facility in Qatar, the people who own that say it's going to be 5 years, 3 to 5 years before they get that fixed. Okay, now second question, if you own a tanker, and after 3 months or so of being stuck in the Persian Gulf, you finally get that tanker out. Are you going back? You going to go fill up again inside there? I don't know. I mean, if you're an intelligent operator, you're going to think twice, three times. I don't know. I don't know if I'm going back in there.
And that's even on top of the insurance companies that are, whether they'll back it or not.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you get burned by a contractor, you going to go buy from him again? I'm not. Okay. So, and the business environment in the Persian Gulf is ruined. I mean, places like the United Arab Emirates and Qatar and all those places, they built themselves on some sort of like a free market haven, where everybody in the world wants to do business here because it's a great place to do business, and you know, we don't have high taxes, and government's not going to get in your way, and even though we're Muslim countries, you know, we got bars and, you know, brothels and gambling and just everything you need to have a gay old time. That's not there anymore. The confidence in that stability is shot. All right. So, I mean, you know, you start at, and again, I'm not trying to paint a pessimistic or a negative picture. I'm just trying to give you, you know, these are the realities. You ask me, you know, what do people in the oil business think about when they hear the kind of nonsense that, you know, that Trump
and let me ask you one more level of granularity. Let's take a look at the fleets themselves, at the tanker fleets, the VLCCs, whatever other kind of categories they have. I mean, a lot of these guys have been sitting, some in the Persian Gulf for months. Some got out, and especially those that got out before the war started. I think the last one that arrived was April 29th, if I'm not mistaken. And that means that they've either had to find somewhere else to get filled up, or they're just sitting out there waiting before they can go back anywhere. And they're not making any money, meaning are they going to still be able to keep crews employed, or will they leave out? And how hard will it be to restart that, to get ship crews so that they can even get back in if they can overcome all the issues with the insurance and the risk that you just mentioned?
Well, that's a great observation. And let's take it a step further. Let's say you're Saudi Arabia. When was the last time you made a dollar on selling oil?
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, and I don't know today what percentage of Saudi Arabia's GDP is oil, but I'm betting it's more than 80%. And the same is true for the UAE and Qatar and Iraq and all of those countries in there. I mean, this is an absolutely devastating economic crisis for those countries. They do not have diversified economies. They are, you know, as close to 100% dependent on oil as they can be, and they haven't made a dollar in 3 months. So, you know, that gets back again to the sort of confident comments that, you know, that Trump made. Well, I mean, if I'm Saudi Arabia, I'm not going to believe a thing that he just said, and I'm going to be working as hard as I can behind the scenes to be making deals with Iran, because I got to make some damn money. I got to figure out some way of getting that oil moving again, or else, you know, if I'm MBS or, you know, all of those, I mean, they got more damn princes and God knows what in Saudi Arabia. You talk about a, you know, a Peter Turchin, you know, overproduction of elites. I mean, those guys are all going to be out on their asses pretty quick if, you know, I mean, if people don't have any money. The first people they're going to, you know, direct their anger at are going to be the people who do, the elites. So, I mean, this is a, you know, nothing ever gets talked about here except, well, what does this do to the United States? At least not in the American press. But there's a world out there that is having, you know, you talked about these tankers. I mean, what have these guys been eating for the last 3 months? They ran out of food and water on those tankers weeks and weeks ago. This is a humanitarian crisis. Do you ever hear about that? No. Because these are props. You know, the people that I mean, these tankers and their crews and the countries, they're just props on a stage. All we care about is, you know, how's it affecting us? And the answer is, so far, not very much.
Let me ask you a different question. So you've very, very effectively laid out just how big it is. Actually, before we wrap this section up here, back to your magic day, and whether that's because everybody agrees or we have some sort of agreement that Iran's going to do a toll, whatever, that they say, yeah, the normal flow can come. As long as you pay my toll, everything can go out there. From that day, how long would you calculate? And I know there's so many factors, but how long would you calculate before something was back to, let's just say, 80% of what it was on the 27th of February?
Never. We're never going back. Never.
No. What's the best case we can get in a year from now?
45%. And whoa. That's not my number. Okay, that's Kepler. I mean, Kepler is a internationally respected organization that does nothing but this kind of work. And I mean, you can go online, you can go to Kepler, you can go on X, you can go wherever else Kepler publishes, and you can see their projections. And they've got, you know, a couple of different cases. And the case that I believe is the most reasonable, based on everything I just said. So, you know, back up. What I just said effectively is that in the most wildly unrealistic situation imaginable, that we can start getting tankers moving through the Persian Gulf in 3 to 4 months. And production that is needed to refill them, if any of those guys ever want to go back into that briar patch, is going to take considerably longer. And so the absolute best case scenario is essentially that nothing changes before the end of the year. That's if everybody makes peace and, you know, and it's kumbaya between all the countries, including the United States, which is not going to happen.
Well, let me ask you this question. Here's an estimate on CNN, which they read, which is definitely not very optimistic. And they're claiming, hey, if you liked $3 a gallon before, you might want to wait a little longer before that comes back around.
So how long is it going to be before we actually start to see some relief? Look at this. This is where we were before the war started. This is where we are right now. There's a huge amount of time that it's going to take, according to the futures market, before we get back down to that sub-$70 an oil level. Look at this, 2032. So you want $3 gas again, you're going to have to wait maybe 6 years.
And you're saying that's if everything works out. But that is a massive difference than Hassett's comment that, hey, by the end of next month, gasoline prices will be so cheap. I mean, you can't hide that much longer, don't you think?
Well, true. Now, you know, in the interest of fairness, I mean, what that guy on CNN just showed is just as much nonsense as what President Trump and Kevin Hassett just said. It's true. I mean, nothing he showed is a lie, but I mean, a futures curve is not the future. I mean, a futures curve always looks like that because a market always discounts the price it's going to pay in the future. Always. That's just the way it works. Okay. And if you actually look at what we call the liquidity, in other words, how much money is actually on contracts? I don't care about 2030, 2032. How about how much money is on contracts in October of 2026? I mean, it's like 20%. All the money's on the front end of those contracts. So there's no money that's out there, and therefore it doesn't mean anything, and it changes every week. So, I don't think that there's... I don't want to, I mean, I got to be an honest broker here. And while everything he just showed tends to support the points I'm making, I'm going to tell you, no, don't believe that, because that's not the right way to think about it. But it does bring up an important point. And that is when you look at the price of oil, you know, if you're an analyst, you know, you're going to look at a screen. If you're an average Joe, you're going to hear it on CNN, or you're going to read it in your newspaper, or wherever you get your news. And that number, you know, today is what is it? It's like $85 for Brent, right? Something like that. $89. Yeah, okay, $89.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, what does that number mean? That is the futures contract for the end of July. So we are discounted 2 months in the future. That's not the price that you're going to pay for barrel oil today. If you want to buy a barrel of WTI today, it's going to cost you $140 a barrel. So that price you're looking at there is somebody's bet on what it's going to cost in 2 months. I'm not saying it's wrong. It's just you got to know what you're looking at. So if you want to buy barrel oil today, it's going to cost you $140, not $89. Now, I'm not saying one is true and the other isn't. They're different things.
But based on
things.
The fundamentals, this is what I wonder if you can help me understand. Based on the fundamentals that you just described about the unwinding and the oil pipelines and the restarting and the insurance, all that kind of stuff, any practical assessment of what oil is going to be in July, if it's 140 spot price, I think they call it right now, it sure ain't going to be 89 in a month and a half from now. So it seems like they would say, no, the best case, it's going to be maybe 120, 130, and yet it says 89. How does that work?
Because that is a risk-weighted number. All right. So now you and I can have a conversation, as we just have, and maybe we can agree that now, you know, the price in July is actually probably going to be like $150, let's just say, not 89. Okay, that's an interesting conversation, and it's well supported by the data. All right, now here comes the hard part, Danny. I want you to take all the money that you have in your savings account, and I want you to put a bet. I want you to buy a contract of oil for oil in July. Okay, how confident are you that it's going to be $150? Because that's not what everybody buying the oil says. They say it's going to be 89. If you say it's $150 and you're wrong, you just lost your whole savings, your life savings. And you're going to start getting real conservative about the way you make that bet, partly because you're looking at what everybody else is doing, and then you're going to ask, well, what exactly is it about the way they're thinking that's different than the way that I'm thinking. And the way they're thinking is this has got to resolve itself. It's going to resolve itself. It has to resolve. It's like, you know, Marco Rubio, he was on a plane, you know, a day or so ago, and he said, you know, this can't stay the way it is in Hormuz. It's illegal.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, and I, you know, I made some comment on X and I said, well, you know, get a ticket to reality, Che. You know, it may be illegal, but this is the way it is. You know, you guys screwed this up, you and your boss. You know, you got nowhere else to look. You did this. You know, stop whining and find a way to make it go away. That's what we need. Not say, oh, it's not fair. It's not fair. It shouldn't be. Okay. So, but my point, Danny, is that futures markets, we're in a situation right now. I mean, you know, I don't know how many times, how sick I am of hearing people say this is unprecedented. You know, everything's unprecedented. Well, I got news for you. In the oil industry, and I've been in this business for 50 years, there is no historical precedent for what's happening right now. So nobody knows how to evaluate it. Nobody. Because it's never happened before. We don't have any analog. We can't say what's going to happen. All right. And so every day there's new information. And some of that information is valuable and some of it is bogus. But the way a futures contract gets settled is there are two people or two parties. There's one party that listens to President Trump, and I'll call that party the dumb money, for lack of a better word. And they're saying, oh, you know, the price of oil is going to be, you know, or, you know, what Kevin Hassett said, it's going to be $80 in a couple of weeks. And so he's going to put his life savings on $80 oil. And there's going to be somebody who has to be on the other side of that trade that bets, no, that's not right. You're wrong. I'm going to make a bunch of money off of this trade, but how far am I willing to go? I'm going to say it's 90. You say it's 80. I'm say it's 90 because I don't need to say it's 100. I don't need to say it's 110. All I need to do is win the bet. And I know if you say 80, you're going to lose. So I've already won. I've already made a ton of money. Okay. That's what's called price discovery. And so we are in a period where the entire structure of the oil market is up in the air. Nobody knows where it's going because we've never been here before. Every piece of information, whether it's true, false, or a rumor, motivates somebody to put some money on the table. And that's why the price is so volatile. It goes up and down and up and down because there's dumb money and there's smart money. That's too negative, but less informed money that actually believes the propaganda that you've just shown. And you know, they wouldn't put that out there if people didn't believe it. And so it takes time before the market digests all of this. Okay. And eventually what's going to happen is the reality on the ground is going to show those guys who lost their ass saying it's going to be $80 in July. They're going to stop making those bids. They're going to say, well, okay, you know, I'm going to make another bet here for August, only this time it's going to be 90. It's not going to be 80. Okay. And there's going to be somebody that says, okay, that's wrong too. I'll say 100. Eventually, you're going to run out of dumb money. You're going to run out of people that are willing to bet low. And by that time, all the effects, the downstream effects of this disruption are going to land big time in places like Europe and the United States.
Yeah,
and then no matter what Kevin Hassett says, everybody's going to say, that's a lie. That's not true because I just went to the gas station and I know. And when is that going to be? That's going to be by July. Okay,
right,
so right now we're living off of our savings account. We're living off of inventories.
So it's one thing to
I can't
to
hear
have
you again.
Dumb money, you can't hear me? You can't hear me again?
Dan, you want to tell me the question and I'll be happy to tell you.
Yeah, and then I'm going to jump out again. Just what is the difference? right now, it's the dumb money and the smart money, whatever has to do with the price here. But what happens when it gets to the point to where there's just not enough diesel fuel to put in the tank and we can't do commerce?
Okay, Art, we have the dumb money and the smart money going at one another. He wants to know what happens when there's just not enough product to be had because of the glut, or pardon me, because of the not being produced.
Well, that's when the price takes off, and that's what I'm saying is that I've done modeling on this, and other people have too, and once places like the United States get hit with the reality of this, and I've already said that it's going to happen sometime. It's not going to happen overnight. It's going to happen in stages, but end of June, mid July, it's going to hit hard. Mm. And by then,
do you hear me now, by the way?
I do.
Okay.
By then, the price on your screen is going to be pretty darn close to the spot price. Then we're going to be at 150. And I think it's going to go higher. I think we're going to go, I've modeled it out to 160, 180.
Wow.
At which point demand destruction kicks in. Mm.
And for those who don't know, can you explain what that is?
The price gets high enough that I'm not going to fill my tank. Or if I do, I'm going to fill it halfway, or I'm going to drive less, or, wherever I can cut my demand for petroleum products, I will. Okay. And so the price gets high enough and I make choices and I don't buy, I don't use oil as much, and everybody else does too. And so we get to, let's say, 160, 170, 180, and then the price is going to drop down because demand is going to drop. And in my models, we're not going to get lower than 105.
Wow.
In the most likely case. In an adverse case, we're never going to get to 130 again. But in the best case scenario, which says that by the end of the year, things, I don't want to say they're normalized, but they're moving in the right direction. Yeah. Okay. And so we're going to go up, we're going to go down, and then we're going to slowly go up, and it's going to stay, the average price of WTI or Brent is going to be 115 or 120 forever.
Okay, so what happens if that's back to your magic scenario where everything got done and we started all the difficult stuff? But what if the dueling blockades stay in place, say through the end of June, and we're still not to that start point? Then
we get to $200 and the same mechanics fall. The higher it gets, the more extreme the demand destruction is going to be. But it's the same scenario. It's just that the price that it drops down to, instead of being 105, is 140 or something like that. I mean, this is a world-changing event, Danny. I mean, there's just no other way to put it. I mean, this is oil is what runs that is the economy. And so, to use a rather crude example that I've used before, if you walk outside your building or your office today with a buddy, and that guy gets hit by a car, and he's all of a sudden, and he's bleeding, and he's losing 20% of his blood supply. Okay, that's the globe, that's the world economy right now. We just overnight lost 20% of our blood in the Persian Gulf. All right, so what happens? Well, you got to get that guy to a hospital. Like, instantly. If you don't get him to a hospital, he's dead, right? All right. Is there anything you can do in the meantime while that ambulance is coming? Sure. Maybe most of the blood's coming out of his leg. Put a tourniquet around that sucker. All right. So instead of losing 20% of his blood supply, he's losing 15%. All right. So in the best of all possible worlds, the guy lives. You get him to the hospital before he dies. And probably he's going to lose that leg. He might lose more. His brain might not work anymore. He might have had a stroke. He might not be able to talk anymore. He may be alive. That's the world we're talking about. You don't do this. You don't bleed out in the parking lot and have everything go back to normal, like Kevin Hassett said. That's not the way the real world works.
And let me ask you that question, because that's something that a lot of people don't understand. They're like, okay, 20% of the global oil supply, gas supply was in there. So, okay, fine. Let's go to the other 80% and just have everybody produce a little bit more, and then we can replace that. What do you say to that?
Well, first of all, it doesn't work that way. I mean, why are we so dependent on the Persian Gulf? First of all, because they've got the reserves and the rest of the world doesn't. But now we're back to oil quality again. All right, so where are you going to get that extra oil from? You're going to get it from the United States? You're going to produce more light beer that you can't use. You know, you're going to get it from West Africa? They got light beer too. You're going to get Venezuela to produce more. Good luck with that. But, you know, there you're going to get sludge. You're going to get tar. You know, honestly, the only other place outside the Persian Gulf that has a high daily supply of the right kind of oil is Russia. So if you're wondering, you know, why we're you know, relaxing sanctions on Russian oil, that's the reason why. Is because, I mean, Russia, the United States, and Saudi Arabia are the three biggest oil producers in the world, and a lot of Russian oil falls into that sweet spot that's real good for making diesel and kerosene and jet fuel, okay? And by the way, I mean, you know, Putin is no fool, and, you know, everybody's all consumed with this issue, he's making his move on Ukraine again, right?
Yeah, we covered that earlier today in one of our shows about what could be coming very soon. Well, listen, as advertised, you are unintimidated and uncompromised to bring us the truth on this, but it's something we desperately need to know. There are so few people who understand the things that you just described here in ways that everybody can understand them, but I'm really, really grateful for you coming on so we at least know what we're actually facing. So thank you so much for that, Art. I appreciate it.
And I just want to, you know, before we leave, I just want people to understand, I mean, you know, this isn't some weird extreme view that only Art Berman has. I mean, there, if you go onto any of these platforms, you know, and look for people, you know, look at what Jeff Curry has to say, look at what Eric Nuttall has to say, look at what Anas Al-Haji, you know, look at what Rory Johnston. I mean, I could continue to name names, you know, people that are, you know, very high credibility, well-respected people in my business. They will all tell you some version of the same story that I just told. Some will be more extreme. Some will be less extreme. Every one of them will tell you this is a world-changing event. We ain't coming back from this hole. Nobody's safe. Nobody gets a pass. The United States is not immune. They'll all tell you the same thing. And there's an awful lot of smart people who are not specifically energy, people that deal with, you know, with bonds and finances. And, you know, I mean, I can think of, you know, a few right now, you know, guys like Tavi Costa and, you know, Bianco Research and look at HFI Research. And I mean, they see the same thing, you know, Mohammed Al-Aryan, you know, over in the UK. They're even, you know, Christine Lagarde and Jamie Dimon, at the big banks.
Yeah.
I mean, they're all telling us a version of what I'm telling you, probably not quite as explicitly as I am. But if you don't believe me, go look at them. Go see what they say and ask yourself, is what Berman's telling us, is he just blowing smoke? Because what you'll find is no. This is the mainstream view among people who know.
Yeah, and I can validate that myself because I have looked at about half of that list there.
Yeah,
that's one of the reasons I wanted to bring you on too. So, okay, all right. Well, I don't know what's going on with my audio, but thank you very much for coming on. I really appreciate it, and I hope all you guys are still hearing me. And we will see you tomorrow on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. You know, thanks. We don't have sponsors because we hate to hit you over the head with ads. I don't like them, so show a little love back. Subscribe, like. and send this to somebody you care about.